Hello. In this lecture, I want to talk about ancient Greek art and architecture. And these two aspects of Greek culture, I think, deserve particular attention for several reasons. First of all, they've both been especially influential on later history, and in fact have shaped the very ways that we think about those topics today. And secondly, they nicely embody many of the core values of 5th century classical Greek civilization. And so they serve as a good way to explain the role of those values in Greek culture. In art, the Greeks had many different art forms. For example, their vases are very famous. If you go to a museum, that's probably what you'll see the most of today, is lots and lots of Greek vases. But in this lecture, I want to focus on just one specific type of art, sculpture. And it's sculpture that most exemplifies classical Greek ideas about beauty, and especially about the human body itself. And similarly, in Greek architecture, the Greeks built many sorts of distinctive buildings, but I'm just going to talk about one of those today, the temple, because it's the temple that is, first of all, the most stereotypical building one thinks of when one thinks of Greek architecture, but it's also one of the most influential types of buildings that they constructed. All right, there are three main chronological periods of ancient Greek art, and I'm going to talk about two of those today, and we'll come back to the third later, a bit later in these lectures. So let's start with sculpture. A lot of the main developments in Greek sculpture can best be understood if you think about Greek sculptors as being on a quest. And it's a quest to find the perfect male body. The Greeks were obsessed with ideal forms. If you think back to the Ionian rationalists, they're very obsessed with ideas of proportion and geometry, and so they applied this to the human body. And to the Greeks, nothing was more beautiful than the naked male body. For them, this was the most beautiful object in all the world. It represents the peak of aesthetic perfection. And we see this all across various forms of Greek culture. In poetry, for example, there's a number of references to how nothing is more beautiful than the male body when it's young and muscular and in the prime of fitness. Greek men always exercise in the nude, and they're always depicted naked. When you go to work out, you go to the gymnasium, and a gymnasium literally means in Greek, the naked place. It even looks like in things like the Olympics that many Greek athletes actually participated in those naked. So for the Greeks, the male body represents aesthetic perfection. The first main style of Greek art is something called archaic style. And it's usually thought of as having begun around 650 BC, though there's some debate about that, and then it ends at 500 BC. And in archaic style art, the typical statue you get is that of a full body of a young, athletic, naked male standing upright. Now, these are easy to spot if you go to a museum, because in archaic style, they always have a very rigid posture. So the bodies will be sort of standing upright as if they're standing at attention. The arms will be tightly pressed against the sides. Usually the feet will be more or less in line with one another. Sometimes one foot is just slightly forward, but the weight of the body is evenly distributed. And in general, this is a very, it's a two-dimensional sort of body posture. It's not at all three-dimensional. It's only meant to be viewed frontally. So you always have the shoulders in line with the hips, the arms at the sides. And when you see one of these type statues in archaic art of a young man, it's called a kouros. Museums are chock full of these. So there are hundreds and hundreds of statues of these kouroi. And quite honestly, they all look almost identical. So they're very easy to spot. They're not at all naturalistic. These are stylized poses. For example, the faces on almost all these statues are exactly the same. They're not portraits of individual people. Instead, they're representations of a type. So they're stylized. They're not meant to really capture an individual. And sometimes they'll even be nameplates. It'll say, this is a statue of such and such historic figure, but the face will still be the same as every other. And even a bit more oddly, the faces are often kind of androgynous. I mean, you can't even tell sometimes if you just look at the face whether it's that of a man or a woman. So these are idealized types. And often art historians have argued that they can see Egyptian influence in archaic style art. And this may be one of the ways that ancient Egypt really ends up having an important influence on all of Western civilization. Now, I've talked about men. What about women? Do we get women in archaic art? Yes, sometimes women also appear as statues and sculpture. But they're rare. It's not as common as men. And when you have a portrait of a woman, you usually find her in exactly the same pose. So she'll be standing sort of at attention, hands by the side, shoulders in line with the hips, a very stiff, formal, frontal, two-dimensional posture. And when you have a statue like that of a woman, it's called a kore. So kuros man, kore woman. And I think this reveals that the Greeks are much more obsessed with the male body than the female. Now, the big difference between a kuros and a kore is that in a kore, when they depict women, she's always clothed. So unlike the male statues, which are always naked, in archaic art, when you have a statue of a woman, a kore, she always has clothing on, and usually fairly voluminous clothing that's really kind of hiding the shape of her body. There's another characteristic of archaic art that's very distinctive and is easy to spot, and this is that many of the statues, both male and female, have a slight smile on their faces. It's kind of a half smile. The corners of the lips are just slightly turned upwards. And this is so distinctive to this period that art historians have labeled it the archaic smile. And it's a little bit mysterious looking, but it's another nice thing to look for if you're wandering to a museum and trying to identify what you're seeing. If you see that little smile, you can say, aha, archaic style of art. Now, let's move to the second main stylistic period or phase of Greek art. And this style is called classical. And it pretty much coincides with the 5th century BC, so from 500 to around 400. And it's classical Greek style that is most influential. This is the one that later eras particularly really fixate upon and look back to, and this is what they think of when they think of Greek sculpture or Greek art. And it's in the classical era that Greek sculptors finally fulfill that quest and identify what they think is the perfect male body. And they define this in terms of a set of mathematical proportions. So they have it defined in terms of they think in the perfect male body, the length of the arm should be a certain ratio of the length of certain fingers, or the width of the shoulders should be a certain ratio compared to the width of the hips. And every part of the body is defined in mathematical, geometrical terms. And here again, we see very much the influence of Ionian rationalism. So it's those philosophers and thinkers of the Ionian era that have now influenced Greek art as well, because they apply this kind of mathematical geometric approach to defining the idealized human body. Now, the most famous example of these idealized proportions is found in a statue called the Doryphorus. And it's just a statue of a man naked again, just like in archaic art, dates to around 450 BC. And this statue gets copied over and over and over again, and in particular, its proportions get copied over and over and over again. In addition to having found the perfect proportions of the ideal naked male body, the Greeks of the classical era also come up with what they think is the perfect position or posture to display this body in. And this is something called contrapposto. It's a specific pose. And in contrapposto pose, what they do is they break free of that rigid stance that we saw in the Kouros. So now, in the contrapposto pose, the statues are depicted with almost all their weight on one leg, and the other leg is extended forward. The hip is kind of cocked to one side or the other, so it's a much more sort of realistic and natural pose. It's not that stiff standing at attention. It's a more three-dimensional pose. So you can view the contrapposto pose from the side or other angles, and it still looks good. It doesn't just have that frontal orientation. And it's much more relaxed. I mean, it's really the way somebody might stand in real life, as opposed to that kind of unnatural position we saw in archaic art. And all of this adds to classical era sculpture a greater sense of personality and individuality. So there's more realism now. These start to look like separate people, not just types. Well, once the Greeks have hit on what they regard as perfection in terms of body proportions and this pose, they repeat it over and over and over again. I could show you literally dozens of photos of different statues, and every one of them would have those same set of proportions, and they will be in that contrapposto stance. And one of the things that later generations really look back at Greek art and admire about it is how it seems to embody or encapsulate certain contradictory impulses. And often art historians will express this in terms of tensions. So they'll say that in this art we see a tension between emotion and restraint, between movement and immobility, between a static condition and a kinetic one. So statues in the contrapposto pose, they look calm, but they have a sense that they're about to jump into motion or burst into movement. And that sort of coiled tension is something that people admire very much about Greek art of this period. The contrapposto stance and those proportions, as I say, are very influential in later art. So many other cultures who come along after the Greeks look at their statues, and they're impressed by this, so they end up copying it as well. Just to give you a couple examples of this, the Romans, when they discover these Greek statues, they too think they're very impressive. And so they start to cast their statues with the same body proportions and the same position. For example, the single most famous image of a Roman emperor is a statue of the Emperor Augustus found at a place called Prima Porta. And if you look at that statue, you'll see it's basically the body of the Doryphorus with the emperor's head simply glued on top of it and then wrapped in some Roman armor. So it's exactly these Greek statues that have just been appropriated by the Romans. And later, in the Renaissance, Michelangelo, another very famous sculptor, he'll be influenced by these as well. And if you look at his famous statue of David, you'll see the same proportions and the same contrapposto stance. So once you know those two things, you'll start seeing them in all kinds of art through all sorts of different periods. Well, having now fulfilled their quest to find the perfect body and posture, it now seems it almost frees up sculptors to experiment, and they start to show people with more motion and much more radical stances. So in the late 5th century, you get an explosion of sculpture showing people in all kinds of positions, running, throwing, walking, throwing discuses, driving chariots, whatever. Most statues of this time are marble, but you also have bronze statues. And the majority of bronze statues have been destroyed. And the reason for this is because bronze itself was so valuable. So hundreds or probably thousands of years ago, most of the bronze statues that were made by the Greeks were melted down for the value of their metal. And the only examples that survive today, usually, are those that underwent some sort of accident that caused them to be lost or buried and forgotten. And in fact, one of our best sources of ancient Greek bronze statues is a little bit strange. It's shipwrecks. That these statues were put on ships, they went to sea, and then a storm sunk them. And what that storm did, though, is it preserved those bronze statues at the bottom of the ocean for several thousand years until the 20th century when we had the technology to recover them. And many of the most famous bronze statues you see in museums were brought up from the bottom of the ocean. The other thing that's distinct about bronze statues is the statue itself is bronze, but the eye sockets are usually left empty. And what they would do is they would insert into those eye sockets ivory eyes. So they have this very kind of creepy appearance of these dark green statues, these sort of glowing white eyes. And sometimes all that survives of a statue is the eyeballs, because the statue's been melted down. So there's a couple cases in Greek museums where you'll just see a whole bunch of little eyeballs on a shelf. And sometimes you'll see eyelashes as well, because those tend to break off. Well, what about women in the classical style? They're still not naked, but now they're shown with something that's called the wet drapery effect. And what this is they'll depict women still wearing clothing, but it looks like someone's dumped a bucket of water over them, so that the clothing clings to their body and almost sort of shows what's underneath it. And in modern terms, we'd call this the wet t-shirt effect, and that's exactly what it is. So the Greeks in the classical era are almost experimenting with a way to show women's bodies, but not yet have them naked, still have them clothed. And it's not until the next era, the Hellenistic era, which I'll talk about in a future lecture, that we get fully naked female statues. Let me shift now and look at architecture. And in architecture, the story of Greek architecture is really the story of Greek temples. So when you think of Greek architecture, probably the very first image that comes to your mind is a shining white temple up on a hill surrounded by a bunch of columns. And that's good. That's a very accurate image, because temples really are one of the finest achievements of Greek architecture. The Greeks, though, don't just start out building those fully-fledged, glorious temples right away, however. It's a slow process of development. And in understanding why Greek temples look like they do and why they have some of the features that they do, you need to understand that the very earliest Greek temples were not built out of nice marble, but they were made out of wood. So way back, you know, maybe even the Dark Ages of Greece, when they first started building temples, they were poor, they couldn't build them out of stone, and so the earliest crude temples were built out of wood. And a lot of the features of those wooden temples will later stay the same when the temples sort of get transformed into stone as the Greeks get more wealthy. So for example, in these early temples, they would simply take trees, chop them down, strip off the bark and branches, and plant them upright, the trunks, to hold the roof up. Well, that's a column. And originally it makes sense because it's a tree trunk. But when later they rebuild that temple, they're used to seeing those cylindrical columns, and so they build them out of marble. And that's why Greek temples have all those columns. All sorts of features of Greek temples. There's often these little marble pieces sticking out just above the columns. And originally, in the wooden temples, these were the ends of the wooden beams that held the roof up, and they would stick out. Now, when you turn it into stone, you no longer have those wooden roof beams, but they're used to seeing something stick out there, so they would put those on in marble. The nice thing about Greek temples is you can date them crudely just by looking at the style of the columns. And there's three basic column styles that develop. The first of these is called Doric. And Doric is the earliest. It's when they were first building temples, and they're not really sure how thick the columns have to be so the whole thing doesn't fall down. So Doric columns tend to be pretty short and squat in terms of their proportions. And the top of the column always has a block of stone on it. This is called the capital. and the capital on a Doric column is just a plain, unadorned block of stone. So if you see kind of short, fat column with plain stone capital, you know it's Doric. Well, eventually, none of these fall down, and they start to think maybe we can stretch those columns. Maybe we can make them taller with more slender proportions. And so the result is the next style of column, which is called Ionic. And Ionic columns have taller, skinnier proportions, and at the top, they're getting fancier. So for the capital, instead of a square block, they now have a square block with two little kind of curlicues on the side that look like rolled up sheets of paper. And these are called volutes. So again, if you see one of those, you know it's an Ionic style. Now, most Greek temples of the Archaic and Classical period are either Doric or Ionic. So those are the two main styles. At the very, very end of the Classical period, they come up with a third style. And this is called Corinthian. Corinthian columns, as you can guess, are even taller and skinnier in proportion. And at the top, they have as their capital these very elaborate curling leaves, and they're the leaves of the acanthus plant. Now, I think there's only something like one Corinthian column in a classical era Greek temple, but later people, the Hellenistic era and the Romans, they'll build a lot of stuff out of Corinthian columns. Another important part on temples is the triangular-shaped area above the columns and below the roof. And this is a zone called the pediment. And it's what you see when you walk into the temple. So this is an important site of decoration. And usually they'll put statues of the gods or things like that there. Another important space on a temple is the zone between the pediment and the tops of the columns. And in that band, you often have square panels called metopes. And the Greeks liked to decorate the metopes with sculptural relief. And the most common thing you get here are battle scenes. Now, the theme of these battle scenes tends to be Greeks versus non-Greeks. So sometimes you'll see Greek warriors fighting Trojans, sometimes Greeks versus Amazons, warrior women, maybe Greeks versus centaurs, which are these half-man, half-horse monsters. Or, if they want to be subtle, they'll put gods versus giants. But you're, of course, meant to read the gods represent the Greeks, the giants represent the non-Greeks. In general, the Greeks are very self-aware of what they perceive as their differences from other cultures. And they like to see themselves as being more rational. So in a lot of their art, they express in visual terms this kind of theme of reason versus emotion, rational versus irrational. And that's not quite true. It's a little bit of a simplification, but it's a way that the Greeks like to see themselves. Another thing about pediments is at the corners, you have a very sharply angled little triangular space, and it's hard to fill, so often they'll have figures who are lying down or kind of crawling up off the ground in these very awkward postures. And when you go to a museum, these statues have been taken down off the temple, and you just see them in the museum, and often people are puzzled why they're in these odd postures. But you have to mentally put them back into the corner of the pediment, and then those positions make sense. The most famous Greek temples are found at a site called the Acropolis. And this is in Athens, and almost every Greek city did have an Acropolis. An Acropolis was a piece of high ground. The word Acropolis is a compound of acro, which means high, like acrophobia, fear of heights, and polis, which means city, like politics. So the Acropolis is the high city. And all Greek cities tend to have one of these things, but Athens is most famous. In the golden age of classical Athens, so the age of Pericles, the mid-5th century BC, Pericles takes all that money that's coming in from the Athenian Empire, and he channels it into building projects in the city of Athens, especially on the Acropolis. So by the end of that time, the whole Acropolis is covered with spectacular buildings. And of these, the most famous is the main temple to Athena, the Parthenon. And that name is because it's a temple to Athena Parthenos, which means Athena, the virgin goddess. And it's often regarded as the most perfect of all Greek temples. It's not the biggest, but it has the most harmonious proportions. Again, that's very important to the Greeks. The Parthenon is a really remarkable building, and it shows how skilled the Greeks' understanding of things like optics and architecture were. Because the Greeks understood that your eye sometimes sees things as optical illusions. So if you see a bunch of parallel lines, your eye will sort of envision them as some of them as being curved or not straight. And so when they built the Parthenon, they actually built it with what initially looks like slight errors. The columns bulge a little bit in the middle. The base of the temple is actually slightly higher in the center than at the two ends. But what all of these slight defects do is they create the illusion to your eye that it's perfectly flat or that they're perfectly straight. So the Greeks actually understood all this and built the structure with incredible precision. And this sort of a false illusion is something called entasis. Inside the Parthenon was, of course, a giant cult statue to the goddess Athena. And it was a statue made out of gold and ivory, so it's called a chryselephantine statue. And it would have been a spectacular thing to walk into the temple and be confronted with this enormous statue. And temples were also used as basically treasuries. You would store all kinds of artwork, weapons, and various other things there. Now, something that it's very important for us today to realize is that even though when we go to museums or we look at buildings like the Parthenon, what we see is shining white marble, that's not the way the Greeks built it. The Greeks originally painted both their statues and their buildings. And they painted them in bright, bright, garish colors. So think red, bright red, bright blue, gold. These originally looked a lot more like Las Vegas than anything that we see today. So we have to mentally restore all of this paint to the temples and to the statues. So the Greeks were not did not create these nice, restrained, white things that we like to think of. They originally had very, very bright coloration, both on their statues and on their buildings. The Parthenon has kind of an interesting later history. This wonderful temple, this wonderful building, almost survived intact up until the present. And the reason why it was preserved is that it starts out as a pagan temple, but then it was converted to a Christian church, and then later to an Islamic mosque. And so they kept this building as it was, and even its sculptures remained mostly intact. That is, they stayed intact up until 1687. And at that point, Greece was occupied by the Ottoman Turks. And the Turks used the Parthenon as a gunpowder storage facility. And, as you might expect, during an attack by the Venetians, it got set on fire and it blew up. And that explosion blew off the entire roof and knocked out the columns on one side. It got worse. In 1806, an Englishman named Lord Elgin went to Greece and bribed the Turks, who were still occupying the country, to let him steal as many of the sculptures as he could. And these were literally sawed off the building. So he chopped these sculptures off the Parthenon, and he took them back with him to England. And if you want to see a lot of the Parthenon sculptures today, you have to go to the British Museum in London. And currently the Greeks have this big lawsuit going against the British where they're suing to get back the Parthenon sculptures, the Elgin marbles, and they built a new museum in Athens to actually hold these things. We'll see where they end up in the end. All right. Overall, Greek art and architecture then nicely reflect a lot of the core values of Greek society at this time. And they really embody some of the Greek ideas about beauty and about aesthetics. They also nicely illustrate that Greek interest in rationality, mathematics, and geometry that comes from the Ionian rationalists. And finally, the buildings they put up also reflect their views about the gods, politics, and just the social values. So we can learn a lot about the Greeks simply by looking at their art and their architecture. Thank you.